So when man finally does what is good for himself, which is being involved in the world of knowledge, what happens is he becomes interested in something outside of himself, which is God's Torah, God's knowledge, and perceiving God's infinite wisdom. So what happens eventually is that eventually the man is not thinking of himself anymore at all. He is in awe, and he is in a state of love and awe of God. That's the affected state. It's the state that Moses was in constantly, always perceiving more and more of God's infinite wisdom and infinite knowledge. Now, this state is a state where man is turned, the soul of man, the mind's eye, is turned outside of the self towards God and towards God's wisdom and God's knowledge. Therefore, ultimately, the perfected state of man is not where he is thinking about himself or where he's even concerned about himself. As a matter of fact, because he is constantly viewing the infinite wisdom of God, he himself, as a personal creature, seems unimportant, completely unimportant. So that's why it says the man Moses was the most humble person on the face of the earth, the Torah says. As a matter of fact, one of the Bible critics says, how could Moses have written the Torah and say that he's humble? That would be the most haughty thing to say. Well, first of all, it's not Moses that wrote those words. He wrote the words, but it wasn't him that authored the words, I should say. He initiated the words. They were initiated by God. So that's the first thing. And the second thing is that when the Torah speaks about humility, it's not about social humility. It's talking about a state of perfection where man, because of the fact that he is constantly awed by God, he himself becomes very, extremely unimportant. And he's not really concerned about what people say about him or whether he's superior or inferior to anybody else. It's an absolute state. It's not a relative state, not a social state. So that's why you have some of the... There's a famous Talmudic piece of Talmud where the Talmud says that after a certain scholar died, there was no more humility. So another scholar said, how could that be? I'm still here. So people think that that's arrogance. No, it's not arrogance, because he was speaking about the perfection of being in a certain state. And he wasn't speaking about social humility. Social humility is really shallow, and social humility is a false humility. People, that's not real humility anyways. People just say, well, I'm nothing. You know, they put themselves down, perhaps, or don't act haughty because they want the approval of people. That's a ploy. It's really false humility. True humility is a certain state of knowledge, and the person that reaches that state knows that he has achieved that state, and he may choose even to tell another individual, if there's a reason to, that he has achieved that state. It wouldn't be haughtiness at all. It's an objective statement. It doesn't mean he can tell whether other people respect him or not, because he himself is in the state of appreciation of God's infinite wisdom, and he himself as a being, he considers himself actually worthless, like Abraham. He says, what am I, a speck of dust in the cosmos? Nothing. So this is true humility. And the point I want to get back to is that in that state, the person is constantly involved in a state of awe and love of God. So the self, the energies are removed from the self. The self is least important, is meaningless. So ultimately, man comes into a state where he is not selfish at all. He's not even concerned with the self. So it is a bit of a trip. When you first start off, you have to start off for a selfish reason. There has to be that motivation. And you keep the Torah because you know that this is the best thing for you. But then, the best thing for you is to be involved in knowledge. Not to be involved in you, but to be involved in something outside of you, which is knowledge of Torah. And that's when man is happiest, and that's when man achieves his true perfection, and his true self is realized. His potential is fully realized at that point. So ultimately, man goes away from the self. It's a bit of a circle, but I think If you think into it, you'll be able to appreciate the concept. You start off with a desire to improve the self, but then the Torah tells you, how do you improve yourself? By study, by knowledge, by following your intellectual curiosity, by searching for God, by searching for God's Torah and God's knowledge. That search is a search away from the self. And the more knowledge you gain of God, the more you realize how insignificant you are as a creature in the face of the of God, of the infinite. So eventually, and the man comes around to a state where he is not concerned with the self at all, and that is the self state. Okay. So, to sum it up, while there is nothing wrong, God wants us to do things for ourselves, and we have to start with that. Eventually, the perfected state is one in which you're looking outside of the self, completely outside of the self, a person of knowledge, a person of Torah. That is the perfected state, again, for Ben Israel as well as for Ben Noach. And that's why we are involved here in the study of Torah for that reason. And that's why I feel we really have to start getting involved pretty soon with the study of Talmud, because that really is the science of Torah. See, Torah is the only religion that has a science that goes along with it. And if you don't have that science, you really cannot appreciate even the philosophy of Torah. You're not going to be able to appreciate it fully, because it's tied together. It would be like a physicist trying to know physics. I mean, you can't do it. You could have a certain concepts, but you really can't. You have to know the science, and the science is tough. I mean, you have to get involved in mathematics and the science of physics. You can't read a Reader's Digest article and really know the science. And as long as you don't get involved in the science itself, your view of Torah has to be, I mean, really severely limited. As I said, even in the perception of the philosophy. So this is something we really have to get around to. I'm sort of giving myself a little exhortation there. Now, let's get back to the question that we were discussing before. The question was, what is the purpose of the clean and the unclean animals? Why did God differentiate between the clean animals and the unclean animals? Now, we have an interesting, very interesting medrash, and this is not, you know, the different levels of medrash. A lot of medrash is the official oral law. Some medrash is certain things that individuals said on their own. That there's a different kind of a... This particular medrash is really not just an opinion. This is one of the foundations of the concept of the oral law. Now, this medrash says as follows. It says... just give me a moment here. He says, in the area and in the very chapter that deals with the kosher and the non-kosher animals, that's found two places in the Torah, once in Leviticus, and once again Moses recapitulates in Deuteronomy. Now, the Medrash says as follows. What does God care whether a person slaughters an animal and eats it, or whether he stabs it and eats it? Do you benefit him, or do you harm him, whether you act either way? Or what does God care whether a person eats a clean animal or an unclean animal? And then the Medrash says, if you became wise, you became wise for yourself. And that's a quote from Psalms the 50, just a second. That's a quote from Proverbs 9:12. Okay. Now, that's the end of the Medrash. A little bit more. It says the commandments were only given to perfect the creatures. Okay. Then he quotes Psalms 12:7, where it says that God's words are pure. Okay, and also he also quotes Proverbs 35. I'm giving you, see if you want to look it up later. which that all the that the words of God are a shield. Okay. Now, what does the Medrash say? The Medrash makes an important statement here. The Medrash makes it clear that the reason why God gave the laws about the clean and the unclean animals and about the slaughtering, ritual slaughtering, what the world refers to, is not because of himself, but it's for the purpose of man. Now, this is extremely important. What this means is that when the Torah says that a specific animal is clean or not clean, it doesn't really mean that there is some difference. Again, getting back to the ark concept, like people think that there's something in the wood. There is nothing in the animal, actually. There's nothing. God does not love a cow, which is a kosher animal, more than a horse, which is an unclean animal. God does not despise a beetle any more than he does a dove. I mean, the universe is filled with God's wisdom and with God's glory, which means his wisdom, and everything that exists exists because of God's will. And God does not look with disdain at any of his creatures. So to say that there really is some superiority in an animal that is kosher over an animal that is non-kosher is, again, going back to the kind of a concept like there's some kind of a difference in the in one substance over another. Now, what is the reason, if that's the case, if really the horse is equal to the cow or the bull or the sheep or the goat, kosher animals, so then, of course, the question is, so why were the people of Israel commanded to refrain from eating those non-kosher types? And it was stated quite clearly and lengthily in Leviticus and again in Deuteronomy, the animals which are permissible and the animals which are not, which are prohibited. And it's interesting, and why did Moses have to repeat that also? That's another good question. Why did he have to repeat it? Why was that part of his exhortation? Is because of the concept of the Torah itself. Many people will say, why do you have to keep kosher? So I'm sure you've heard people say, well, kosher animals are more healthy. If you eat pork, then you can get trichinosis. But the pork isn't the only thing that was prohibited. A horse will not give you trichinosis like pork, and a horse is prohibited as well, and so is the camel and other animals. So it has nothing to do, it can't have anything to do with health. That's a nonsensical reason. It's a reason that people, somebody thought it up because he thought of the pig and he didn't really even know what the Bible states, the various animals the Bible came up with this idea, and somewhere or other that idea took off, like David mentioned before, the myths, you know, that become factual in people's minds. But if you look at the Bible itself, obviously that answer does not hold any water. Now, but if you look at the Bible does give you a reason for God commanding the B'nai Israel to keep kosher, to only eat certain foods. All right, kosher is not the proper term. Kosher just means something which is correct. But at any rate, that became the use of the word. Kosher means the clean animals. But it means clean, and also means they're done when it's slaughtered properly. Now, if you take a look at Deuteronomy 14:20, okay, it says you shouldn't eat any nevela. That would be a dead animal, okay? I don't know what your translation is. I'm reading from Hebrew. Is it carrion? Could be. Anyways, it says, to the stranger that is in your land, you shall give it, and he shall eat it, or you can sell it to the stranger. Because you are a holy nation to God your God. And then it says you should not cook a goat in the milk of its mother. Okay? Now again, does this make any sense to say that one animal is, God is saying that you should eat it, but you should sell it to the Gentile or give it to the one that's a stranger in your land? Is that proper that God want to harm one of his, another creature, another human being? This obviously makes no sense whatsoever. So the reason is not because the animal that's unclean has anything wrong with it in any way. It is the system of keeping kosher is tied to holiness, because that's what the verse says. See, the verse actually gives you the reason at the end of the entire chapter. It gives you the reason. It says it has to do with being holy. And if you take a look at Leviticus, again, speaks about at the end of the chapter, it mentions about also the concept that you should be holy to your God. That is Leviticus 11:45. The man took you out of the land of Egypt in order to be a God for you, and you should be holy because I am holy. Okay? Now, what exactly is holiness? So, in the Christian world, holiness is some kind of a mystical substance. But in the Torah world, holiness has a very definite property. Holiness means set aside, removed from the instinctual. That's what it means. That's why it says, because I, God, am holy. Because God has nothing but instinctual or anything physical in any way. So what God is saying to the people is that you should emulate me insofar as your nature allows you to be removed from the instinctual. Here is the clue as to what exactly the idea of kosher is, keeping kosher, eating the clean animal, not the unclean animal. And the reason is pretty clear. The reason is that God wanted, gave the B'nai Israel at that time the opportunity to perfect themselves. And what is this? How does this opportunity express itself? It expresses itself in a very simple formula, that your repetitive drive, the drive for food, is a very powerful one, extremely powerful. Well, we see in today's world, people are just concerned about trying to control it for their own appearances, and they still can't do it, which the desire itself is not really, is nothing more than an egoistic desire, and still have a hard time getting the instinct under control. But the Torah is saying that man, before he engages in the instinctual and appetitive drive, must first think. He must be able to use, his mind must come into play here at this point. Take a look, for instance, at Leviticus 11:47. To distinguish between the unclean and the clean, and between the animal that can be eaten and the animal that is not to be eaten. What does this verse mean? When we say differentiate, differentiation in man is in the Torah and in the oral law, the scholars of the oral law. Differentiation means knowledge. Of course, the first step in knowledge is to differentiate. Man would not have any science if he couldn't differentiate. Science begins with classification. What is classification? Classification is differentiation. There's this type, and then there's another type. And then you differentiate into their various categories. Differentiation is the first step in knowledge. The Torah is telling us here is that in order for B'nai Israel to be holy, what they must do is they must gain total control over the appetitive drive. They can satisfy the drive. That's fine. Never, never tells man not to satisfy a drive that God instilled in man. The drive is there for a purpose, and it's and God wants us to use it. But, and this is important, before man does, he must use his mind. In other words, there must be a supremacy of the mind over the emotional, over the appetitive. So when man desires food, he's very hungry, and he smells some good food, he must think to himself, just a moment, is this the kosher food or the non-kosher? Was this slaughtered properly? Now, and then if there's a question, he may have to even take out the oral law, which I can tell you could take him sometimes hours to determine whether something is really kosher or not, because, as I said before, Torah has a science attached to it, and that is the oral law. And sometimes you have to involve yourself in that science to find out whether something is kosher. It's not always as simple as people think. So, many times, the person will not be able to eat supper, but he'll have to take out the oral law and delve into the problem until he comes to a conclusion, or if he can't, he's going to have to consult someone who can. So there we, holiness means where is a supremacy of the intellect, of the mind, over the emotional and the appetitive. The man can eat, but he doesn't eat like an animal. An animal, the moment it has the desire, nothing stands in the way. It immediately goes for the food. Man must be able to stop, to think, to differentiate. This I will eat, this I will not. Okay? This I have to refrain from, no matter how painful it is. There's a supremacy of the soul over the instinctual part of man. That is what this means in the eyes of the Torah. So, then man is living with that part of him that reflects God, the divine image. And he's partaking of holiness because he's approaching the removal of the self from the instinctual. God, of course, is the one that is completely removed from any kind of physical or instinctual. God is the source of all wisdom and all knowledge and all existence. So man tries to emulate God in that way, and then he's living as a human being. That is the reason for kosher. The reason for kosher, you don't have to search for too far. If you just take a look at the Bible itself, almost spells it out, but as I said, you have to read a little bit between the lines. Now, just one moment. Okay. Something else which I'd like to bring to your attention as well. That idea that there must be a supremacy of the mind over the emotions applies not only to the area of the appetitive, before I get off this point, but it also applies to the area of the sexual. That's why Rashi says that you should be holy. So Rashi says it means separate from the prohibited sexual relationships. And the reason is, again, because that is where the concept of holiness expresses itself. And not in abstention from any sexual, total abstention from sexuality. That is incorrect. To say that God created the, and he doesn't want man to use it as a pure nonsense in the eyes of the Torah. The commandment that was given to man was to be fruitful and to multiply. But he can partake of sex, and he can enjoy sex. However, there's one requirement. Before he does, he must be able to differentiate. That he can have sex with this individual, but not with that individual. And as you probably know, there is also in the Torah the law, which we call in Hebrew nida, which means that that during the period of menstruation, of course, it's a little more complicated than that. It's not just menstruation; it's actually menstruation plus. But it's certainly during the period of menstruation that the husband and wife cannot cohabitate, and that's a prohibition. Which means not only that the individual has to refrain from having sex with certain individuals on a permanent basis, even where it's permissible, he must be able to exercise control and say, during this time, he will not he will live with his wife, and vice versa. The wife, of course, will not live with the husband. And during another time, they can. So there are two types of self-control that are expressed in this in this halacha with regard to control over the sexual drive. But basically, the two drives, and that's why Maimonides, in his 14 books, one book he calls the Book of Holiness. In that book, he has laws pertaining to the permissible and non-permissible, as permissible and non-permissible intercourses. And the reason is because the two most powerful drives of man are the sexual drive, and then you have the appetitive drive. And both of those drives must never control. They must never take over the human personality. They must never be the prime mover of the soul, so to speak. The prime mover of the soul has always got to be the soul itself, the mind, and the wisdom. And then properly directed, the instinct can be satisfied. And then man should satisfy his instincts because he should be happy, he should have a happy existence, and then he's existing and satisfying his instincts as a man, as a human being, not as an animal. And that is the state of holiness. That with regard to kosher as well, you have that same thing. Just like with regard to the sexual, there is sometimes the prohibition where one is never permitted to have sex with a certain person, and for instance, somebody else's wife, an incestuous relative. And then again, even in the case where it is permissible, but under certain conditions, he cannot have another form of control. By the way, the reason for those two forms is because each one has its own difficulties. Some people have a difficulty saying, well, I could never have this enjoyment. That bothers them very much. So they have this fantasy, like, I could never, I know, as a matter of fact, some people in the yeshiva, they say, every now and then the question comes up, well, let's say you find out that you were not a Jew. What would you do? And inevitably, someone says, well, the first thing I do is go out and have a McDonald's hamburger. So before I became a Jew again. Because the idea that you could never have that in the mind of man, I can't ever have that. It must be great. It must be unbelievable. As a matter of fact, by the way, you may be familiar with the statements of the rabbis about the tree of knowledge. And they ask, what kind of a tree was this? And there's an argument, some bring a proof from the verses that it was a fig tree, some say it was even wheat. Nobody says it was an apple, by the way. And there are different possibilities. Some say it was an esrog, different fruits. But why does the Talmud say that? Why don't they just say it was some kind of exotic fruit, some kind of unbelievable fruit? The way the Torah, the way the Bible describes it, the Bible says, and when the woman saw the fruit and how luscious it looked, and the appearance was so, it had such a magnetic appeal to it. So you think it's some kind of unbelievable fruit that we've never seen. And the Talmud tells us, the scholars of the oral law, was a fig, or maybe it was wheat, or whatever. Why do they say this? The answer is very simple. The answer is, what the woman saw in the fruit, it really was a regular fruit, there was nothing special about it. But before she could have it, when she thought she could never have it, as long as man thought, I could have this, man starts projecting.
Right, we got 60 seconds.
60 seconds, okay. Man starts projecting onto that which he never can have all kinds of qualities of how great that is. I must be able to have it, at least really was what happened in the Garden of Eden. That it was just an ordinary fruit. But once God said to Adam and Eve, you cannot have it, they started to imagine that there was some they started to see unbelievable properties in that fruit. The properties, of course, were from their own fantasy and their own imagination, and because of the fact that the prohibition was a final one, that you can eat from every tree in the garden except this one you cannot eat from. The prohibition is what gave the fruit its attractive qualities. Okay, we'll have to stop here, and we'll continue with the same subject next week.